tonight on Arena. A new documentary on the comic ecstasy of Peter Sellers and new albums from Mark Lanigan, Hayley Williams and Swimmers Jackson up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. From a permanent presence in the iconic The Goon Show, from any of the radio series which launched comedy as we now know it, to a global superstar through his portrayal of Chief Inspector Jacques Clouseau in the Pink Panther series of films, Peter Sellers died 40 years ago this coming July. He was just 54 years of age at the time. And he is the subject of a documentary called Peter Sellers, A State of Comic Ecstasy, which will be broadcast on BBC Two television tomorrow evening at 9 p.m. Paul Whittington has watched the documentary for us and he joins me now. That title, A State of Comic Ecstasy, I thought when I saw the title first, Paul, I'm going to find out all the secrets of how Peter Sellers made comedy. I'm going to find out all the secrets of how ecstatic he was in the process of doing so. And I'm going to be a much wiser man about his artistry at the end of it. It's not about that at all.
No, Sean, it's not really. It's more about the famously chaotic and dysfunctional private life he had. He was married 4 times, briefly, happily the first time, but he had this constant fixation with beautiful women and with a need to be mothered. So this documentary, which is very strong on that side, is a bit short in terms of the career stuff. The title comes from, it's a Stanley Kubrick quote, because on Lolita, which he made with Kubrick before, and he was very good in it before Strangelove, Kubrick would let him run with stuff, and he would describe the state of comic ecstasy that Sellers would get into, but it needed to be controlled. And in fact, Steve Coogan in this documentary says that Kubrick was one of the few people who could kind of control it and bottle it, because he could be very loose otherwise. So you get a lot of personal stuff and not to only a very sketchy idea of what his career, his brilliant career, was.
I'll come back to the Dr. Strangelove aspect later on, because there's very, we do get a sense of what he could do when literally the mic was open and he was told, go. we'll get a sense of that. But we do get a sense from very early on that his childhood and his family, very hard to get at the personal side of things here, hard to get really in there. But we do get a sense in terms of his early childhood that things were not that great for him.
Well, I think he was an only child, and his parents, his mother, Peg, to whom he was very close, and friends like Spike Milligan found it on his relationship with them sort of creepy and uncomfortably close as a grown-up. But before his name was Richard, I think, before Sellers was born, they had a stillborn child who they had named Peter. And they started calling him Peter. So one can imagine the psychological consequences of that. But they were both in the music hall in different areas. And I think he was taken on stage when he was 2 weeks old and he started crying. In a very interesting Parkinson interview he did in the mid-70s, one of the very few revealing interviews he did, he talked about hating, really not liking the stage when he was small, and these sort of creepy actors with deep voices who would talk to him, and you know.
Yeah, let's listen to that. Let's listen to that clip, Paul, where he's describing in that interview, as you say, with Parkinson, because a couple of things in that interview that I really want to get to. But here he is talking about, what he felt about the world of the theatre.
I really didn't like that period of my life as a kid. I didn't like the touring. I didn't like the smell of grease paint. Used to hit you when you went into any stage door. There was sort of a smell of size. That's the stuff they paint on scenery, you know. And grease paint and baritones with beer on their breath and makeup on their collar. Always deep voices. Hello, little Sonny. How are you? Are you all right, little boy? Dear little boy. Who is he? Who is he? And I used to spend my time sitting in dressing rooms and whatnot. And so I didn't like that. This is probably why I hated being in the theatre, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
It's amazing that you're having...
All connected with it.
Yes, and having hated that in fact you became involved in it. But you learnt music from your father, didn't you? Can you remember a song that Dad taught you from those days?
You sing a little song. It's sort of very dated now, but it's quite, you know, sweet little thing, really. Mm. I've got an idea, soon she'll be cooking my breakfast, wait and see. I haven't told her, she hasn't told me, but we know it just the same. Saturday night.
Michael Parkinson interview there from 1975, Peter Sellers on the ukulele. And we're speaking this evening with Paul Whittington about a new documentary due to be broadcast on BBC Two television tomorrow night, Peter Sellers, A State of Comic Ecstasy. The little ukulele sound there kind of foreshadows the Goons in some ways, doesn't it, Paul?
Yeah, well, he was a big George Formby fan. Mm. He was obviously a brilliant mimic. He during the course of that interview, actually, you could hear his voice heading to different accents. Amazing mimic. He was when he grew up, he was a drummer first and mainly in the armed forces during the war. He was in the entertainment section because he had bad eyesight. He wanted to be a pilot, but his eyesight was bad. And then after the war, he returned to acting, and he sort of spoofed his way into radio by pretending to be somebody. And then he met Milligan and Seacom, and they started doing the Goon shows, which were considered scandalous by senior people in the BBC when they started. And they were intensely creative. Milligan wrote most of the, and Michael Benteen to begin with, wrote most of the screenplays. But Milligan always said he depended on Sellers' ability to play, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 different people in the same radio show. And it is very, very difficult to believe, listening to them, that he's doing all the different voices. Really amazing talent.
In fact, when he agreed to do that Parkinson interview, didn't he say, I will do it, but I want to be in character all of the time. I don't want to be Peter Sellers at any point.
Yeah, that's right. He the day before he was due to do it, he said, I'm not doing it anymore. And then he was told he could come on as someone else. And what he did was he dressed up as a Nazi and came on and quoted some lines from The Producers, which he'd originally been offered a part in, but had turned down and always regretted turning down. And that seemed to allow him then to ease into the interview. He was a very shy person. He always said himself that he lacked the components of a personality. And he may not have been joking, because Britt Eklund, who's one of the, there are lots of archive interviews in this, but one of the new ones is with Britt Eklund, who was his second wife. And she's very forthright and very interesting. And she reckons that he may have been bipolar, a very difficult person to be with, whatever it was. But he just, there just didn't seem to be a him, as it were.
I want to listen to another clip. I'm not sure if it's from that same Parkinson interview or not, but it's Sellers at probably one of the most honest moments we get from him in the entire documentary, I would hazard a guess, because obviously it's all archive material in his case and very few interviews to be tapped into. But let's have a listen to this.
I mean, I have a name of being very difficult. I'm not difficult at all. I just cannot take mediocrity. I just cannot take it on any level. And I'm not difficult. It's just when people just don't seem to know or have the basic knowledge of what makes A and B tick that gets me. You know, for example, I'm often written up as being, you know, nasty on the set. I'm not nasty on the set at all. The end product is all that matters. The end product.
Real passion from Peter Sellers in that clip. The end product is all that matters, Paul Whittington. Yeah. Do we get a good sense of that very ambitious artist, it must be said? Do we get a sense of that in this documentary?
We do in patches, particularly. I know you mentioned you're going to talk about Dr. Strangelove. I mean, you do get a sense of what he was capable of at certain times, although a lot of the early part of his career, these brilliant films he made in the 50s and early 60s in Britain, are ignored. But his, you know, perception is everything. His health became bad. He had after he married Britt Eklund, he had a massive heart attack in Los Angeles, and thereafter had heart problems. And Spike Milligan always reckoned that affected his character. But he became extremely difficult. He was always falling out with everybody. He was a very thin-skinned person. When he worked with Orson Welles on Casino Royale, the Bond spoof, he wouldn't be on the same set as Wells, probably because he felt threatened by him. And Wells described him in one of the biographies as, you know, this dreadful little man. He was very hard to be with when he was like that. I think for those who knew him, there were certain people who were going to, apparently him and Kubrick, can you imagine, two more sort of demanding, difficult people, they got on fine. But on a general level, he could be difficult. But he did have a perfectionism, but he needed to be corralled, as Steve Coogan says. He needed to be really tightly focused. Milligan did it for him on the Goon Show, and some directors through his career did it for him as well.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, Dr. Strangelove was where Kubrick managed to do that with him. He played three roles, in fact, in total. I want to listen to a clip, and if my memory serves me right from the documentary, this is Sellers totally and absolutely improvising. Kubrick said to him, listen, off you go, pick up the phone. You're on the phone to Russia and there's been a problem. And Sellers just improvised. So we'll hear that bit first. He's under pressure as the American president. And then we'll hear Sellers himself speaking about working with Kubrick.
One of our base commanders, he had a sort of, well, he went a little funny in the head. You know, just a little funny. And he went and did a silly thing. Well, I'll tell you what he did. He ordered his planes to attack your country. Well, let me finish, Dmitri. Well, listen, how do you think I feel about it? Can you imagine how I feel about it, Dmitri?
We had an idea about how Dr. Strangelove himself should appear. And Stanley said, what about the idea that his hand had been injured in some terrible nuclear fallout experiment? So then we put this black glove on, and then suddenly from the black glove we got the idea that half of him was Nazi and half was American, you see, and suddenly this hand started to go up. Well, this came out of just talking and throwing ideas at each other. This part is fine. I enjoy this. I enjoy working with a creative director who can sling ideas to you and you can sling them back, and out of it comes something good.
Peter Sellers there in a clip from Dr. Strangelove, and you heard Sellers himself talking about how it was working with Stanley Kubrick, who of course directed the film. Paul Whittington has been watching the documentary, Peter Sellers, A State of Comic Ecstasy, speaking with me about it this evening. That's probably, the documentary really puts Dr. Strangelove as the height of his career? And is that fair, Paul?
The height of his film career anyway. Mm. Certainly Steve Coogan does. But I would argue that there are three or four very good British films he made in the 50s, like I'm All Right, Jack, which isn't mentioned, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Sean, in which he plays Fred Kite, a union leader, and it's kind of a serious role, and he's brilliant in it. The Mouse That Roared is mentioned. Alec Guinness was a great hero of his. In fact, he impersonates him very well during the Parkinson's interview, and he played three or four characters in The Mouse That Roared. He wanted to be that kind of actor, I think. Mm. It became very difficult for him to find vehicles subsequently, and he had a terrible, terrible slump. He was a bad chooser of scripts, and in the late 60s, 70s, he made a lot of very bad films indeed.
But of course,
returning to form with a film that a lot of people really loved, which was Being There at the very end of his career.
But as we've intimated, a lot of this documentary is taken up with his marriages, his relationships with the various leading women he was playing opposite, and he seemed to be almost incapable of separating the character he was playing from himself, and therefore constantly falling in love with his leading women. Let's listen to one of those women, Sinead Cusack, in fact. She speaks about what it was like to work with him on the 1970 film Hoffman.
Peter did ask me to marry him. But I think, I think the reason Peter asked me to marry him was probably because that's what Mr. Hoffman would have done. The plot of Hoffman is, I don't think it could be made today. It's about a middle-aged man who blackmails a young, vulnerable girl into coming and living with him for a week.
Miss Smith, please make yourself look as though you want to be fertilized.
Thinking about my time of working and knowing Peter, I suspect that that there was a sort of transference in him, and he saw me in a way as Janet Smith.
Sinead Cusack there speaking about working with Peter Sellers on the 1970 film Hoffman, and that's one of the clips from the documentary Peter Sellers, A State of Comic Ecstasy. She intimates that, and I think Britt Ekland had a sense of that as well. You were saying, Paul Whittington, that Britt Ekland actually is she, and there's a lot of controversy around this, this is what all the press material has been about in recent weeks and days. She really gets into the heart of the matter, his behaviour and how he managed his personal life, or mismanaged his personal life, I suppose you could say.
Well, I have to say, and always has been honest, she was 21 when she met him. He was about 38, I think. And she was working on a film. And she says her sort of career ended almost at this point. Instead of asking her to marry him, he rang her and said, "I've told the press I'm going to marry you." So he was very manipulative. Mm. And they did marry. And then he whisked her off to L.A. to this kind of, you know, McMansion over there, and he took her off a film set. She was fired from the film, and she describes their marriage, and it's not good. And this is where the sort of bipolar idea comes from, where, you know, on Fridays there'd be this awful fight, he'd say awful things to her, and then on the Monday it would be sort of make up again, and it was this up and down roller coaster. And she's very honest about it and very convincing, but we hear in archive from wife number one, with whom he was apparently happy until he became infatuated with Sophia Loren. And sort of invented this relationship with her in his head. So he seemed to be always looking for this kind of woman who was going to be like a goddess, but also mother him. He even said that himself. He had a kind of a strange view of women, I think.
Yeah, and Nanette Newman, he developed an obsession with Sophia Loren. As to whether it was requited or not, that's a question we can't answer. Nanette Newman, the same type of thing. Sinead Cusack clearly giving us a sense of her situation there. And Britt Ekland, very much part of the story as well. What about other members of his family? Because there were children from both the Britt Ekland marriage and the first marriage, Paul.
Yeah, there was a daughter from the Britt Ekland marriage and a son and a daughter from his first marriage. And it's quite sad with the children, because I've read about this before in biographies. He seems to have had sort of no filter as an adult with them. He used to, when he was fixated with Sophia Loren, he woke his son up and said, "Do you think I should leave mommy?" and things like that. He seemed to have no sense of what was appropriate and what was not. And sometimes he would be present as a parent and then completely absent and would be nasty to them, which is obviously worse than being absent altogether. Yeah. And he had several incidents with his daughters. He just didn't seem to understand the concept of being the protector, the parent. So he was a pretty disastrous parent. And he sort of admitted it himself, in fact, and did in moments where he reconciled with his son regret all that.
Yeah, and the whole documentary is beautifully bookended by his grandson, who ends up at the end of the film watching, being there, and we leave it to those who view the film to find out how the grandson reacts to watching being there and what his ideas around that are. Yeah. What would you say then, Paul, about this documentary, Peter Sellers, A State of Comic Ecstasy? Did you know anything further about the artist, or was it really about the man, and did you know any more about him by the end of it?
I think that, Sean, thanks to Britt Ekland in particular and just one or two other contributions, you did find a little bit more out about... I knew there was the mother and all that kind of stuff, and Peg was very dominating and that he was very shy, but you did get a sense of just how sort of floundering this person was in terms of his and lost and how little sort of happiness his own career brought him. But in terms of the artist... not really at all. And if it had, perhaps it could only do so much in the time. It's about 75 minutes long, I think. But really, the egregious thing is to miss out on all that British stuff. He tried really hard to become a film actor in the 50s, and he put in some brilliant performances in Ealing-type films, and we get none of that. Mm. And we don't get a sense of Pink Panther's mentioned, but we don't see A Shot in the Dark, which is actually a very, very funny film and shows his whimsical side at its best.
All right, that's Paul Whittington speaking to us about that documentary, Peter Sellers, A State of Comic Ecstasy. It broadcasts tomorrow night, Saturday at 9 p.m. on BBC Two. 25 minutes past 7 on Friday night's Arena. It could be said that in his first book, To Be a Machine, Mark O'Connell went some way towards solving the problem of death with his exploration of AI and transhumanism and how the latest technology might circumvent our mortality. Now O'Connell is back with a new book, Notes from an Apocalypse, in which he's been off on his travels again, this time to meet people who are preparing for the end of the world as we know it. Declan Hughes has been reading Notes from an Apocalypse for us, and he joins me now. Personal journey to the end of the world and back again. When we see apocalypse in the title of a book, how much anxiety is always the question I wonder is it at play? How much is there in this book from Mark O'Connell, Declan?
There's quite a bit. I guess he's two modes here. One is personal. He talks about his own personal anxiety. He's in therapy. He's drawn to the apocalypse and notions of the apocalypse and repelled by them, and eventually feels this will be his subject. He'll almost write it out of himself. And then, as you say, there's the travel aspect where he goes on these journeys, these investigations into the world, and the various manifestations of apocalyptic thinking that he reports on effectively. I think the reportage side of his work is the stronger, not to say that the introspective stuff doesn't work, because his voice is just so buoyant, so self-deprecating, engaging, ironic. You know, he will approach an anxiety and then make you laugh about it.
Yeah.
And so that works very well. But sometimes there's just maybe a little too much. It feels like he's still pitching the idea of the book that you're actually reading. But when he gets to the places, the episodes, they are just fantastic creative nonfiction in the classic sense.
Again, in the current climate, once we see a book with the title Apocalypse, how did the author know? How did he or she get it so right? How were they so prescient in what they were writing about? So O'Connell is looking at several possibilities for how we might wreck our planet and our current civilization. But I don't think pandemic it comes up as one of those possibilities.
It's mentioned when he talks about the preppers, who are quite familiar to us. The preppers are a version of survivalists. They're also men's rights activists and they're white supremacists. They're not a glamorous bunch. And these are guys who've been waiting for their fantasy moment when civilization breaks down. They assume, of course, that everything will be a disaster and that they will be the only ones with bunkers, with canned goods, with guns, you know, these very funny on dried food that they've stored up, and this character who's got a huge supply, and it seems his problem is not so much the apocalypse as the fact that his wife has left him and he doesn't know how to put his dinner together. Interestingly, the twist on that is the whole idea that these guys think, if it came to it, I'd find out what I was made of. And O'Connell has lunch with a friend of his who works in publishing, a woman, who says, she has this what they call the bug out bag. They'll have a bug out bag under the bed so that they can get out with the necessary supplies. She said she has one of those, because she'd like to know what she was made of. And he speculates that maybe in a world where women can be raped and will question whether they will go to the law, that women are a little bit further down the road of apocalyptic thinking than men are. But he's also that the rival tone enters. He says he doesn't want to find out what he's made of. My suspicion was that it was not first-rate material.
And the majority of the preppers he meets, am I right in thinking that they are in the United States, and that they believe they'll go off to a little corner of the United States that will be perfectly safe with their guns and their tinned food, and all will be well.
Yeah, and there's code, you know, that's not very, very opaque code, rural versus urban, basically meaning white. Versus the problem will, the cities will all be destroyed, but these guys will hide out in their redoubts. And then he goes to South Dakota, where there's an upper grade, an upper tier of these bunkers. You can $35,000 a pop, and you can hide there. But then one of the most persuasive episodes is he goes to New Zealand, and Peter Thiel features in this. Peter Thiel is ex-PayPal. He's a tech billionaire. Yeah. And what's called the apocalypse contingency plan. So New Zealand has become a kind of a hideout for billionaires when the catastrophe hits. And this is based on a 1997 blueprint co-written by William Rees-Mogg, father of Jacob and former Times editor. And it's a sort of blueprint for this libertarian future where democracy will collapse, the state will become obsolete, and a cognitive elite will emerge. And there's an echo of the colonial past of New Zealand before England colonised New Zealand. There was a New Zealand company, so business was its first master. But there's a terrific walk-on part for Jacinda Ardern in this.
Yeah.
And she also was, when she got into power, her government began to repel these sort of rich billionaires from using New Zealand as the site of their refuge.
Yeah, because the 35,000 that the preppers were going to spend on their bunkers in the United States is nothing to the type of money that these predominantly men, and these are internationally elite and very wealthy men, they'd be prepared to spend a bit more than 35 grand. That'd be peanut money for them.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, billions, beachfront property. And Thiel is also, amusingly, he calls his various business enterprises by names from The Lord of the Rings. So there's, again, the element of fantasy is very strong. But it's fiercely political, and his political analysis, he describes himself as a socialist at some point in the book, and you can feel that rage in the Mars chapter. He goes to the proceedings of the Mars Society in Pasadena, and the dreaded Elon Musk is one of the participants here.
Yeah.
There's a whole notion. He talks about how when Americans talk about colonizing the red planet, what they're really talking about is recolonizing America or reinventing America. And when they're talking about reinventing America, they're talking about a new frontier where there'd be no need for governments or tax or regulation or community. And so you have this ex-military guy, Art Harmon, talking about how, you know, your passage would be paid by a company. And when you got there, the company would run you. The company would be your government.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's suppose... I guess the fact that it's the red planet that they might be going to colonize in Mars, that might tell us something about the majority, the politics of the majority of these very wealthy people.
For sure. Except beyond Trump, I think. That's a sort of science fiction version of Trump. I mean, a lot of this reads like science fiction, like Philip K. Dick and or Isaac Asimov with the Foundation and Empire, the whole idea there. And he's very culturally elusive. There's lots of very nicely chosen references throughout.
What I wondered, though, I mean, was to what extent is he in a state of despair, given that climate change becomes an important argument, I think, in some of the later essays as well, or some of the later chapters. To what extent is he despairing, Mark O'Connell, here? Or is there a sense of hope that, in fact, we might manage to avoid an apocalypse?
Well, I don't think he ever concludes one way or the other and is wise not to, but I think he the experience of being a parent seems to alleviate some of the proximate anxiety for him. I mean, he begins the book with this capsule of a cartoon bear his son is watching on the TV and a starving polar bear scrabbling in a bin. And that's almost the inciting incident for the whole journey. And by the end, he's had another child, and it seems to, it sounds trite, perhaps it isn't. But I think the circling round the fears maybe in the cathartic way art does alleviate them without solving them, I think. is as best as I could describe it. There's a wonderful sequence in the Chernobyl exclusion zone, which does what it says. You know, there's no need for analysis. You're just walking through this desolation and children's classrooms and things left just as they were. And then at a certain point near the end, the Reactor 5 cooling tower, he quotes from Isaiah, a city will become a hunt for jackals, a home for owls. They'll possess it forever. And he notices two kestrels circling round the tower inside the ruins. And then he says, he says they're looking, the ruins are like trees to them. They're just part of nature. And he says, only the world remained and the things that were in it. And that becomes eventually that kind of imagistic presentation becomes its own solution. He makes a kind of observation that, so it doesn't become a sort of, you know, intellectual speculation.
And finally, then, would you say, Declan, that Mark O'Connell's book is one for reading now as an uplifting experience, or maybe, you know, to give us some sense that this too will end and we'll be all right?
I can't say I was delighted to take it on because I'm a bit of a, at the moment, a bit of a Poirot and P.G. Woodhouse merchant. I'm in hiding. But I would recommend it highly. I think the voice, the wit, the liveliness, and it engages politically in a way that is very, very inspiring. So yeah, I would say read it now.
Read it now, says Declan Hughes of Mark O'Connell's Notes from an Apocalypse, A Personal Journey to the End of the World and Back. The book is published by Granta. And so into the final lap of this week here on Arena and Album Review Time. Straight Songs of Sorrow comes from grunge survivor Mark Lanegan. Paramore frontwoman Hayley Williams releases her debut solo album. It's called Petals for Armour. And Dublin singer-songwriter Swimmers Jackson releases his debut album. It's called Marmorations. We'll start with Mark Lanegan's Straight Songs of Sorrow. We spoke about the memoir with Tony Clayton Lee on Monday evening, I think it was, earlier in the week at any rate. Sing Backwards and Weep, the name of that book. But Brian Boyd and Louise Bruton have been listening to the three albums, and before we speak with them, let's have a listen to Bleed All Over from Straight Songs of Sorrow.
Baby, 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 don't you say it's over, yeah. I never wanted to, baby, 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 I'ma bleed all over, yeah.
Bleed All Over, the title of that track from Mark Lanegan's new album, Straight Songs of Sorrow. And as I said, our true reviewers this evening, Louise Bruton and Brian Boyd. And we talked about with Tony Clayton, it was Tuesday night, in fact, that I spoke to him, Brian. We spoke about Lanegan being one of rock and roll's great survivors, never mind grunge. Is this a new Mark Lanegan we're seeing, a reinvented Mark Lanegan?
Not really, Sean. It's an indictment, really, of popular culture that Mark Lanegan has quite, as you said, has quite the musical CV. But he's hitting the headlines this week because he's been involved in a social media spat with Liam Gallagher from Oasis. Basically, Lanegan invited Liam Gallagher out for a fight. It's all coming together this week for Mark Lanegan. There is the book, as you featured earlier this week. There's the solo album. It's not really anything different from him. What this album is that the book, Mark Lanegan had quite the dysfunctional background. There's a lot of drinks, a lot of drugs involved, a prison sentence. Music basically saved him from being a career prisoner. The book dredged up all these horrible memories from his past and also his very picaresque time in the music industry. He was best friends with Kurt Cobain. They were obviously neighbours in Seattle. And what this album is, it's a sort of an accompaniment, a musical accompaniment to the book, where he really sort of delves deep into his past. And you get, there's some beautiful songs here. And as you heard there, that voice, that bruised baritone voice, it's one of rock's great voices.
Louise Bruton, you came to this album, I think, Louise, with quite high hopes from this 12th solo album from Lanegan. Were those hopes fulfilled?
No, I was very disappointed with the album, to be honest, because I've always been a Mark Lanegan fan, and to know just his input to music over the years from collaborating with Queens of the Stone Age and then working with Isabel Campbell on Ballad of the Broken Seas, this just scratches the surface of what he has actually done for music over the years. And this album, I think, just doesn't even go beyond the surface level of what he is capable of. I don't even think his voice sounds as great or as grovelly as it usually does. And I just think there's a lack of grit that we do associate with him. And it's quite likely that he saved a lot of that for the book, because from the sounds of it, the book seems like it goes deep and dark.
So he wrote it down into a book rather than giving it to us in songs, and that disappointed you. But what about the voice that Brian spoke about? You really didn't think that it had the same grit and gravel and growl?
There is something lacking. I feel like maybe he's just working off somebody else's sheet for this one, because a lot of the time when you do listen to his previous material, you feel the pain, you feel the anguish, you're walking in the shadows with him. And I feel like this just feels like it's somebody else is reading, right, reading his story.
But come back to you on this one, Brian, because I know that Skeleton Key, which is a big song, and it's a long album, 15 tracks, in fact, and Skeleton Key is a big song at track 9, 7 minutes and 5 seconds long. And there's a quote with it, there's a lyric within it, "All my work won't add up to a dollar." How negative is he? Do you agree with Louise that it's somebody else that's kind of almost putting the words in his mouth, or did you get an honest outpouring from him here?
I agree with Louise in that the first three songs here, Sean, I wouldn't want to say Apples on a Tree, This Game of Love. I thought this would be one of the albums of the year. It was all very stripped back, and that vocal and the lyrics were very, very heartfelt. And as the lyric you quoted there, they were very much introspective, very much summing up his career. But then you go on to tracks, you get into the middle of the album, into the core of the album, and suddenly he starts mixing around musical styles. He brings in blues, he brings in electronica, he brings in a sort of an indie rock sound, and then a small army of guest artists arrive. Now, they're all very famous in their own right, and they obviously do their own virtuoso thing. I just think he threw too much at this. He could have, the first three songs showed it was just him and his memories and that voice and those very penetrating lyrics, but he just seemed to go to bring all his friends in. It seemed like they had a great party in the studio, but musically the album really suffered. It dipped. It did come back towards the end, but I just felt that he lost the momentum and he just tried to do too much.
But let me listen to a little bit of Skeleton Key, and this was a standout for you, was it, Brian?
Excellent song. It's one of the best songs in the album, yeah.
Skeleton Key, it won't open up. Bent and rusted, your precious skeleton key.
Skeleton Key there from Mark Lanigan's Straight Songs from Sorrow. And just as I ask you to summarise, Louise Bruton, did not even that, Geb, touch your heartstrings? Ugly, I'm so very ugly, love me, why won't you love me? And he, you know, he's kind of laying himself pretty bare in that song, is he not?
No, he is, but I would feel with someone who has such a strong back catalogue as himself, I really would have hoped that lyrically that would have hit me harder, if not lyrically, but even in his delivery, because he is undeniably just one of the greatest songwriters and vocal performers of all time. But I just, there's something just missing in this for me. I don't know what is, it's some edge is gone for me.
All right, a disappointment from you. How does that translate into stars, Louise?
Two stars, sadly.
Too sadly from Louise. And Brian, I think you're a little bit more positive on this.
3.5, Sean, but I do think it's a missed opportunity. I think there's a great album within Mark Lanigan. The book is great. This album isn't as good as the book, unfortunately. That's a very damning indictment to say to a musician who's not a writer.
Yeah, your book's great. Sorry about the album. Straight Songs of Sorrow, the first of our albums this evening there, Mark Lanigan. Let's move on then to Hayley Williams and her debut solo album, Petals for Armour. Petals for Armour aren't going to protect you too well, I don't think, Louise. Did she need protecting heading in? Did she need to protect herself in some way heading into this album?
I think there is a sense that Hayley Williams has had to kind of undo a lot of protection that she's gone through over the years, because she has been famous since she's been about 15, I think, is around when she started out being the front woman of the band Paramore, and she's now in her early 30s. And she's just out of a divorce from someone she was with from when she was a teenager, and she has had a tough time with the band Paramore. So she is going through all of these, she's reliving the experiences of the last 15, 16 years of the limelight and being in a marriage and being in a troubled band, and she's kind of finding a sense for herself. So this album, I think, if anyone is familiar with her previous work, it's completely against what you would expect. It's kind of indie pop rock, and it's really delicate, even if the content of it is quite hard-hitting. And her voice, I think, is just phenomenal on this. Again, it's not something you would expect if you knew her previous work, because she's really experimenting with herself as an artist and kind of seeming to relearn who she is as a person as well.
Troubled band life and troubled personal life, a divorce and a broken band. That sounds like we're going to get, again, a 15-song, quite a long album from Hayley Williams here, Brian. Is that are those the general themes, break up and break down?
Very much so, Sean. And they always say that you stop developing emotionally at the time you become famous. And Hayley Williams was a number one rock star when she was, as Louise was saying, when she was just 15 years of age. Now in her third, I mean, she's now just stepped off that Paramore, the band she's the lead singer with, were a huge ongoing concern, like massive stadium rock success. She's just stepped off that treadmill. And this album really is a sense of growing up over one album, the whole last, in her mid-30s, she suddenly had emotional maturity. The voice is a thing of wonder here. Like, when she was the front person for Paramore, she had just to scream to hit the back rows of the stadiums. Now she's using her voice far, far better. And she's also, bizarrely, she said the Spice Girls were a big influence in this album. And you can hear the bubblegum pop coming through, which is something she never would have allowed herself with her old band, because they're very much hard rockers. There's touches of Bjork also. There's that beautiful, she has that beautiful idiosyncratic take also on her vocals. So you get this weird mix of bubblegum pop and very eccentric left field indie pop meeting halfway. And there's some beautiful moments on this.
Right. Well, that I think the bubblegum pop comes a little bit more towards the end of the track listing. But let's listen to the opening track, which is called Simmer. Love the opening lyric on this.
Rage is a quiet thing. You think that you tamed it, but it's just lying in wait. Rage, is it in our veins? Control.
Simmer, the opening track from Hayley Williams' new album, which is called Petals for Armour. Rage is a quiet thing is that opening lyric that really stopped me in my tracks when I heard it earlier on today. Is that what she does across the album, would you say, Louise Bruton? Does she keep the rage contained, quiet and under control, which she talks about in that song, or does she let burst and let it all hang out later on?
I think she's really learning how to manage rage, because there's a sense that she maybe had to kind of stay quiet for... Even though in Paramore there was a huge, there's fury at the front of their band, I think in her personal life she kind of kept her rage under wraps, but now she's learning how to release it. She sounds like someone who's gone through extensive therapy to kind of find comfort in the life that she has lived. And this album, Simmer, is about the abuses that all the women in her life have gone through. So she's looking back and trying to piece her life together. And yeah, it is. She's really managing her emotions in a really admirable way. Even songs like On Dead Horse, she is trying to shed the shame that she carried with her for most of her life, for starting a relationship with a man who was married to somebody else. So she's really just learning how to accept the things that she's done and move on.
Yeah, and I think that's also there, Brian, in a song that was one of the highlights for you on the album, Sudden Desire, that sense of, you know, running with what you're feeling and maybe letting the control go a little bit.
That was such a change. I mean, first of all, it's an R&B song, which she's never touched before. And it has these beautiful stop-start musical dynamics. It's very, very different, very, very fresh. Lyrically, it opens her up. Musically, it opens her up. And the sense you get is that when you're the lead singer in a globally successful multi-platinum band, you're almost obligated to go off and do your solo album, but then come running back to your day job 9 months later when the solo album doesn't really perform. This, however, raises a lot of questions. Paramore are officially on hold, but I think people will be surprised just how strong this album is, that it's not just a diet Paramore album. It's Hayley finding a whole new artistic vision for herself. It spells the end of the band for me. I don't think there's any going back, because this album is just very high quality.
Right, I'll listen to a little bit of Sudden Desire before I get your stars.
I wanted him to kiss me how, with open mouth and open mouth, we keep our distance now. I wanna feel his hands go down. I try not to think about what happened last night outside his house. Too far to go back now. Just wanna feel his hands go down. Sudden desire.
Sudden Desire, the name of the track there from Hayley Williams and her new album, Petals for Armour. Stars from you, first of all, on this one, Brian Boyd?
4 stars.
4 from you, you enjoyed it. And what are you saying, Louise Bruton?
Yeah, very, very strong 4 stars from me as well.
Very strong 4 from both of you. Let's move on then to our final album, an Irish release this evening, Murmurations, debut album from Summers Jackson. This is a debut solo album as under this title, Swimmers Jackson. Who are we talking about when we talk about Swimmers Jackson, Brian?
He's Niall Jackson. He's a Dublin musician. Niall would have served his time in the trenches in a number of local Dublin bands. He's usually bass player. He's usually the guy at the back of the band. So he's not used to being up front and centre himself. He moved to London a few years ago, and this is his first time fronting up the whole operation. It's a beautiful album. There's plenty of ideas going on here. There's some great, great songs. I just felt the production on this was very muddy and very tinny and didn't really he didn't fulfill his full potential, but there's some wonderful ideas on this.
Well, let's have a listen to a bit of the opening track, which is called, it's not the opening track, it's the second track, Summer's Here.
Down, the weather is great in Dublin. Everyone's on the canal, drinking cans, bottles of wine. Yeah, they have
a little bit of nostalgia for Dublin, but unfortunately, if he were here, I don't know if he's in Dublin at the moment, but there's nobody sitting along the canals and enjoying the summer sun. Unfortunately, Louise, That acoustic guitar feel that we get there, lo-fi aspect to it, is that what you had expected from this album?
Definitely, because when Niall is performing with Bouts, Bouts would kind of sample a lot from kind of that Californian garage rock sound, and you can hear quite a bit of that in this album as well, particularly on Birthday Girl, which is you could definitely compare it to a Weezer song, no doubt. But the rest of it is quite hazy guitar rock. And it's quite introverted as well. And you get a strong sense of that Niall is living in London and missing Dublin. He's nostalgic for that, but also trying to figure out life in a different city and trying to move on at the same time. So there's quite a lot of kind of mourning and loss and just looking at things through different glasses.
And Brian mentioned the production. How did the production sound to your ears on this album, Louise?
Yeah, there is moments where it does kind of chop and change a little bit. Initially, it's quite a slow pace, but then it feels as if as he works his way down the track list, he gets more comfortable in his surrounds. And it would be interesting if in the next outing, if things become a little sturdier in terms of whether or not he's going for a lo-fi or more of a kind of a garage rock sound.
Although that song that we listened to there, Brian, by those harmonies, I think is that the side of Swimmers Jackson that you would like to see developed more as he moves into his second album?
Very much so, Sean. There's material on this album I've never heard before on anything by an Irish artist before. And that's why I'm being very harsh in the production, because I think there's some fantastic ideas here. There's times where I was reminded of early Crosby, Stills and Nash. There's other songs where I was reminded. There's a song called Replaceable, which sounded like something like from the Herman's Hermits from the 1960s, just pure pop. There's incredible ideas, incredible talent. There's a song here called Bliss, which really deserves a much wider audience. The reason I'm frustrated with the production is I think that there's some great stuff going on here. He just didn't do it justice. If you talk to any record label boss or any big name producer, this is the sort of artist they want to work with. Someone who obviously has really fresh original ideas and someone they can really develop. There's great stuff here.
Stars, Brian?
3.5.
3.5. And finally, from you, Louise, stars?
3 stars from me.
3 stars from Louise. That's for Swimmer Jackson and Murmurations, and the other two albums that Louise Bruton and Brian Boyd speaking to me about this evening: Petals for Armour from Hayley Williams, and Straight Songs of Sorrow from Mark Lanigan. And that is our lot for this evening, and indeed for this week here on Arena. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields were the researchers. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Patrick Carney was on sound supervision this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Damien O'Mara. Have a great weekend. Look after yourself. Look after each other.